Hey, everybody. My name is Kevin Smokler, and I am the co-director of the 2021 film Vinyl Nation, a documentary dig into the record renaissance that you just saw. Vinyl Nation is about the 15-year renaissance of vinyl records in America. And if it wasn't evident from the trailer, Vinyl Nation was made before certain events of the last 2 years. Certain events that have changed the business of making and the experience of acquiring and playing vinyl records irrevocably. We are no longer in an era where the renaissance of vinyl records is a novelty or a conversation starter. Vinyl is here. And the vinyl sector of the music business continues to grow, pandemic or not, for 15 consecutive years now. Last week, the RIAA reported that in America, vinyl records had grown 61% in 2021. A decade and a half into its renaissance, sales of vinyl in this country have topped $1 billion. The question now before us then could seem as direct as this panel's title. What does the ecosystem of vinyl look like here in the present, and what is its place in a rapidly changing future? Because it is quite clear in terms of opportunity and possibility that we have only begun, pardon me, to scratch the surface. At the same time, we all know it is not that simple. This moment on the cosmic flat circle after the Apollo Masters fire of early 2021 and 2 years of COVID, the full-fledged return of Record Store Day next month, the coming of music NFTs and new technology products to empower both musicians and fans arriving by the week, is a moment that will require clarity, imagination, and guts. And of course, the humility to know what you do not already know. I feel incredibly fortunate to have these three folks, these innovators, as guides through these questions, difficult as they may seem, for vinyl makers and technologists, for musicians and for fans. So here's who is here with me. At the far end of the table is Karen Kelleher, founder and CEO of Gold Rush Vinyl, right here in Austin, Texas. Gold Rush was named one of the most innovative companies of 2020 by Fast Company magazine. And before starting Gold Rush, Karen was the head of music app partnerships at Google, where she managed Google Play's relationship with top developers like Spotify, Pandora, and Shazam. Before that, she led business development efforts at Songkick and at Paste magazine. To her left is Felicia Booker, a musician advocate and the founder of the venture-backed Breaker Nation app, which we're going to be talking about at this session. And to her left is Eric Sanchez, the founder and owner of Normandy Records in Los Angeles, an independent record company, Creative House, and online record store. Let's give it up for our panel, folks. All right. So, we do not have a small issue in front of us. If everybody, starting with Karen, and could we just go this way from the end of the table back towards me? Take me very quickly through the last 2 years, as uneventful as they may have been, and what pivots your business has had to make in regards to both the pandemic and milestone events in the vinyl space, like, of course, the Apollo Masters fire and the canceling of Record Store Day, and all that stuff.
I feel like PTSD coming on as you think about it. My company today, which is a vinyl pressing plant, looks completely different than it did 2 years ago. The ambitions and goals we had then really have shifted, and that it did start with the pandemic. We were deemed a non-essential manufacturer and fought our city and state to say, yes, music is essential. And especially when musicians were not touring, vinyl became extremely critical for their livelihood. We were able to reopen, and when we did, found machines like ours like to run. And when they don't run, you have parts breaking, and then found out how hard parts were to get because of factory closures in other countries that make the metal parts. And then you tie that all together with how important vinyl has been for fans of vinyl and for artists, and demand has been through the roof. And so, you know, what we used to really be known for was fast turnarounds, which was 6 weeks consistently on every project. Now we're at about 6 to 8 months out on projects. So a very different company, but I'll tell you, the one thing that nobody ever questions anymore is vinyl a fad? It's very clearly not a fad anymore, and that's a question I never have to answer to investors anymore, especially.
I'm glad to hear that. Felicia, tell me what the uneventful last 2 years has looked like for you and your company.
Yeah, you know, I think right after COVID, I pivoted my business. Previously, it was called Hear Back, and it was really just super focused on musicians. And while that still is why we exist, I also had a chance to really dig into some other ideas that I had around the fans of music. And I've always been a vinyl enthusiast, and so just kind of getting active in more communities and talking to fellow fans about, you know, possibilities to connect people who love vinyl with new music. Because a lot of times when you think about vinyl, it's, you know, catalog and, you know, records that came out beforehand. But I think that there's such an amazing opportunity just to connect new music and these dedicated, you know, vinyl fans. And so I would say that would be the biggest difference for me.
Eric, same question for you.
Yeah. Well, operating as a record label and an online retailer gives you a perspective from, you know, from for the fans and from the consumer, from the buyers. So finding new ways to communicate and finding ways to provide service in a time where maybe shipping was not stable or consistent or products aren't available to ship at the time you said you were going to send them out. So providing that very consistent, friendly service in a virtual world, which is what we had to do during most of the last years, has allowed us to kind of grow in certain ways and learn a lot about how we can operate moving forward. So that, I'd say that's probably the biggest.
Karen, you mentioned this a little bit in the last thing I asked you, but what question do you get most often on where your business is now and where your business is going? As a person in the panel who sort of is most in touch with the wax becoming records.
Yeah, like I said, the biggest concern people had when I said I want to move to Austin, Texas and start a vinyl pressing plant in the age of Spotify was how do you know that it's not just a blip, right? That this isn't just a quick fad. And the data has been super helpful to see those stats. And a lot of that growth in the past year has been driven by people living at home, you know, working at home in this little space and saying, what does this space say about me? How can I bring more life into my home when I'm, you know, stuck on Zoom screens all day long? And that's been very helpful. So yeah, I don't get asked that anymore. What I do get asked is, how fast can you make vinyl? And it's been hard for us as a manufacturer because the reason I started the company was I was a band manager who couldn't get anyone to press my vinyl. The major labels had taken all the capacity, and for us not to be able to fulfill that right now because of how much demand there is really a struggle. And so, yeah, I get probably 4 or 5 phone calls a day from people in my network asking, can you please pull a favor for me and put me in the front of the line? And that's the biggest question we get asked now from everyone.
Remind me, is this the time to speak to the Jack White announcement of the last 2 days?
Yeah, happy to. Do you want to recap what it is? I just read the letter, so.
Yeah. Jack White recently posted an open letter on the website of Third Man Records. Jack White owns a record pressing plant in Detroit, in addition to some of his other endeavors, basically saying the system is stretched as far as it can go. We can no longer. We need the major record labels to reinvest in opening vinyl pressing plants. Because I believe the phrase to use is it now takes as long for a human being to be conceived in pregnancy and delivered as it takes to press a record, mm-hmm. So this came out I believe on Monday, mm-hmm. What does this look like from the point of view of
Well, I'm not a vinyl person by nature. I came from the digital music space, and I'm happy to have a team that have built this factory with me. And so my naive question when I started was, why don't the major labels own pressing plants? You know, Sony used to have capacity in Japan. I've worked in the major label system a little bit and seen just enough to know that for them, vinyl is such a blip compared to the digital revenue they make. You know, Sony, Universal, these are companies that are doing billions of dollars of revenue a year. So to invest in a pressing plant to earn that much little more money on the grand scheme of things is not... it's not something that they want to put their time and efforts into, which is frustrating. My counterpoint to this whole thing is just stop taking major label orders. And my plant does not have any contracts with major labels because it those prevent us from helping independent artists. And it's really hard to have that discipline to say, oh, I really want to take that job because I love that artist. But, you know, it starts to clog the plants up. And so, you know, as an independent plant, I'm lucky I get to make that choice. Not every plant can because of their size. But that's the answer, is just to force them to, if he feels that strongly about it. And we certainly haven't taken major orders because of that.
Felicia, could we talk a little bit about Breaker Nation? It's I'm a complete geek when it comes to tools and methods to discover music, and I think it's fair to say Breaker Nation is probably my favorite that I've come across in the last 4 or 5 years. Tell us a little bit about Breaker Nation and what problem you feel like the Breaker Nation is solving in music discovery, and if we can tack on to the end there, where does vinyl fit in its future plans?
Yeah, sure. So I feel like for a long time it was or has been perpetuated that for an artist to be successful, they just have to promote on social media. But I actually think that's not true. I think that you have to find people who want to advocate on your behalf, and I think you need a team. And so at Breaker Nation, we work with musicians to help them build a team from the ground up that's actually going to promote their music. And so the way our app works is you upload your music, it goes into our queue, and everyone in our community can give you reviews. So first you're able to find out, is this the record you think it is? Is the mix good? So on and so forth. And then when people love your music, they can join your team. And as an artist, you can say, hey, I need help with Instagram, or I need help with streaming, or, you know, how can we all work together to run it up? And so that's really what we're building at Breaker Nation. Definitely a musician's first company, and we really want to put musicians in a position of power so that they can just do more of what they love every day. Vinyl definitely comes into play because when you look at monetization for musicians right now, everyone knows that it's a struggle with streaming because of the rates. But I honestly think that, especially for the wide variety of artists that exist, it's not always about having the most fans, but the most impactful fans and the ones that really connect with you because of who you are uniquely. And when I look at vinyl consumers, I feel they're very dedicated. They spend money. And I would argue that, you know, for certain types of artists and maybe certain types of music, that if you had 1,000 fans who are like really into vinyl and buying your music, that could be more valuable than 10,000 on the streaming side. So we really look at it as a way to integrate sustainable solutions for musicians to be able to make money. That's really what I think about. I think the last thing I think about in our app, we have audio rooms. We haven't super launched them yet because I don't want anyone starting a room to talk about anything. but I definitely have a vision for one day, like all the record stores, you know, like we could have Record Store Day in Breaker Nation, you know, and have good conversations about what happened behind the scenes of records and swaps and talks. So I definitely want to do that in the future.
I love that idea. I'm glad you brought that up. Eric, I'd love for you to speak to, we are a month away from Record Store Day, and Record Store Day is the kind of, you know, 800-pound gorilla of vinyl sales in a year. Record stores, as many have told us, do as much business on the second Saturday of April as they do for their entire Christmas season, for example. I'm sorry, the third Saturday of April. But Record Store Day is also, as it's gotten as big as it's gotten, is incredibly problematic in what it takes to be able to participate in Record Store Day, get access to product that is sold exclusively on Record Store Day. Tell us about RSD from the point of view of someone who does e-commerce business in vinyl. And if you are unsatisfied, I have a feeling you are, how would you like to see that change in the future?
Well, I think right now Record Store Day is defined, well, to be a participating store, it has to be a fully focused retail physical location that's focused on music, on vinyl, CD, or cassette, or other formats. I mean, the biggest term there is physical. And I mean, I run an e-commerce shop that I think could provide access to people who are in towns that may not have record stores. You know, those people are then forced to have to buy on secondary markets and pay triple the price for a record that's super rare and they're not going to get a repress. So I think when it comes to Record Store Day now, compared to what it was in the, when it first started, I think, not to be overly critical of Record Store Day, but I think a little bit of innovation and adapting to the modern collector could perhaps help Record Store Day take that next step. You know, the kids who are 13 years old and are buying their first records, now they're not really familiar with the typical going to the store and dig. It's the reality. I've had kids who reached out to me from TikTok to buy a record through Instagram, and they don't have an email, but they want to buy the Travis Scott LP. And what am I supposed to say? Email me and then create friction? You know, I think when I think of collecting records, I think of the many different behaviors that are involved in that. And that comes in age groups, that comes in platforms, in many different ways. So I would like to see Record Store Day maybe implement or dedicate a small percentage, if they don't want to commit too much to e-commerce, maybe 5% of total product goes to e-commerce shops. Tower Records is back and it's 100% e-commerce. And you're telling me I can't get a Record Store Day from towerrecords.com? There's something missing there. So that's my only slight criticism of RSD.
No, I'm really glad you brought that up, because I think, you know, RSD is now the biggest music-focused event in the world, in terms of the number of people who participate and the number of countries that it happens in, and yes, I think you're we thankfully, when we made this movie, we got a fair we've had a fair number of young people seeing it and saying, I'm a record person, I love records, but I don't go to my local store on Record Store Day. And I say, oh really, how come? And they'll say, because I don't want to wait in line for 4 hours first thing in the morning. And then I'm like, well, who says you have to do that? Like I'm 48 years old, the hell I'm getting up first thing in the morning to go, you know. But am I going to get up at 11 and show up at the Record Store Day at noon? And then call my wife at 4 and say, oh, sure, I'll be home soon, I promise. And like, and then I show up at 7 with like 3 handfuls of records. Like, yeah, that's I think that's a lot of people's versions of Record Store Day. And we have this notion that Record Store Day is all, I think Record Store Day has done this to themselves. They have created this notion that Record Store Day is all about exclusive product, that half the people who buy it are going to turn around and sell on eBay tomorrow, and that you have to sort of run this gauntlet of waiting in line to participate in it. I'm like, no, just friggin' go to the record store. Like it is no happier place on earth to be than at your local record store at about 2 p.m. on Record Store Day, after everybody who's been waiting in line in the morning has gone home. But I think that's a mess they've created for themselves.
I also think it creates an experience, for the most part, where people leave unsatisfied because they can't get the record they want. And that's, like, I don't think this record retailers are in the business of creating bad experiences. Like you just said, it's one of the happiest places, but some people are just sad because they can't get, you know, the Britney Spears B-sides, you know? It's a real thing.
Yeah. Karen, let's bring up this ugly word, supply chains, and like, is that something... Is there something that can be done about that, or is that too big a problem for any one person or any one sector of the vinyl market to solve? Is that like weather? We're just going to have to wait until it gets better?
I hope not, but mm-hmm. I've also learned that hope is not a strategy. So when we talk about the vinyl supply chain, I think one big thing is that a lot of the mess is because of the demand. We're just ordering as people more things lately and having them shipped home. So the first supply chain crunch we faced as a pressing plant was actually cardboard boxes. Our cardboard box distributor cut us off and said we have too many orders. The other plant was 3 weeks backed up, and suddenly that's a ricochet effect, because now you've got records sitting that can't ship out, and then the turn times get longer. The second was plastic, which is what we use, polyvinyl chloride, to make vinyl. That has been held up in for cargo freight ships in Long Beach Harbor for weeks, waiting on plastic. Lately, it's been white paper sleeves. I mean, it's just we as people are consuming a lot more stuff. And so that's a universal problem. And now you add embargoes happening in Russia, and that affect our nickel prices. We use nickel to make metal plates. It's just kind of just this perfect storm of everything. That said, we've actively for years been looking for other distributors and suppliers of these materials. The vinyl industry is very consolidated with how many suppliers there are. There's about three companies you can order plastic from, three that make metal plates here in the United States, one that really makes white paper sleeves. And so my hope is that all of this is going to force some more people to look at manufacturing these things domestically to save us on freight charges and time. But it's a problem that's not going to easily go away, as it won't for the rest of the economy, unfortunately.
Yeah, for those who don't know, when we referenced the Apollo Masters fire at the beginning of this session, the Apollo Masters is a company in Southern California that is one of two, I believe, manufacturers of lacquers, which is the first step in the process of making records. Apollo was one of two companies in the world, the other one in Japan, that makes lacquers, and the facility suffered a catastrophic fire. Thankfully, nobody was hurt, but the facility was destroyed. And in a minute, the floor dropped out of the very first step in the chain by which vinyl records are made, mm-hmm. And that was in January of 2021. I think we're only
2020. That was like before COVID really even hit. It was like, this year is going to be gnarly. Let's see how this goes.
Yeah, I mean it was predicted that was going to stop the revival of records dead in its tracks. Thankfully, it did not.
Well, what happened, and I hope this is what happens in the rest of the supply chain, is people saw that opportunity and rushed to make lacquers and get invested in that. And now there are too many lacquer makers because Apollo's back up and running, I hear. But it does point to, you have to be very kind to your vendors, especially because there's so few to choose from. And when push comes to shove, and this is part of the problem with the big companies taking all the capacity, is, you know, I'm doing 2% of the United States vinyl. Like, I don't have as much negotiating power as a plant that has 40% of the buying power. And so it is tricky. We're looking for alternatives outside the industry. Like I said, I'm not a vinyl person, so we're going to people who make plastic for dice in Las Vegas and saying, that's the same kind of plastic. Can you guys make plastic for vinyl records? Or ideas like that are a little bit out of the box, but will give us some more flexibility.
I want to talk, the vinyl is one half of this very interesting, one prong of this very interesting way forward we see in music right now. Vinyl is explicitly physical. And, you know, we're not going to get out of this room alive without talking about NFTs. So certainly not now. So, Felicia, if you wouldn't mind, I'd love to talk to you about vinyl and the relationship it has with your sort of other project, which is coverage of what's happening in the music NFT space. And I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so I think last year, as we all know, like, NFTs were going crazy. And typically when that happens, I kind of like tune it out a little bit because it's just like a lot of hype. But then I think, like, what does this really mean? And so the first thing I thought about was the experience of NFTs, like actually playing them as a fan. Like, it's all about like the enjoyment for me first. And actually the first thing that came in my head was a vinyl record player that had an optional screen to play vinyl NFTs. That was like the very first thing I thought of, because I just thought, like, wow, if I'm already playing records and I buy these NFTs and then I have it hanging on the wall in my house, like, oh, that just seemed like it would be such a great thing to do. And as I started researching more, I started to see how in the Web3 space, a lot of the technology is still new. And, you know, there are so many companies kind of doing the same thing and not a lot of uniformity, I think, even though the blockchain is there. But I think that there are a lot of opportunities to mix the two and really just build for, like, super duper fans. And so I'm excited about that. Don't necessarily have all the resources to build this NFT record player in my head, so if you're in the audience, let me know. But outside of that, I just started covering things that are going on in the music metaverse on a site called felly.xyz. And so it's good to kind of see who's out there and who's doing what.
Yeah, it's a great bleeding edge sort of look at how music is changing.
Yeah, and I think a lot of times with innovation, companies typically think about the next generation. Like, they always think about the kids, you know, but not taking into account like there's a huge consumer base. And it doesn't have to just everything be for the kids, but I think it could be cool for them too. And I think especially now with us moving in an era where it's really about the experience, what does it look like? What does it feel like? What is the sentiment behind it? And so, yeah, lots of opportunities.
Eric, I'd like you to talk about some of those opportunities. You and I have had a couple of good conversations about opportunities in the music NFT space. If you could include some of the positives and some of the negatives, and also how you got here to South by Southwest specifically.
I sold an NFT to pay for my expenses, and that's how I got here. It's really fun. I hadn't sold an NFT prior to that. I actually wanted to see how real it could get, and it's pretty real because I'm here. But the ideas that we had conversations about were imagining in a practical way how we can reward collectors from a retail perspective, or from an artist or a label perspective, from the many different points from which a vinyl collector buys their product. Because a vinyl collector is none like any other collector. They're going to buy the repress. They're going to buy the color variant. They're going to buy the one that was pressed in the Netherlands, the one that was pressed here in the States. It's a fascinating way to collect anything. And with blockchain technology, I think that there's an opportunity to reward them. Specifically, the idea that Kevin and I were talking about was a subscription service that lives on the blockchain as an NFT, where you get to know your consumer more, where you get to give them records and can be even activated through token-gated platforms on e-commerce websites, and many different ways. We even went as far as maybe to imagine a record store in the metaverse. You know, I look at kids who are 13, 14, 12, they're all on Fortnite, they're all on Twitch, they live a very virtual life. Why can't we imagine an easy transition from them in whatever metaverse they're into to just go straight into a record store, listen to records the way we did at Tower back in the day at listening stations, just in a virtual space? I think these things are very possible. Obviously, as Felicia mentioned, the technology is very new, and there's a lot of things that we need to figure out before we can implement these things. But primarily, it's how do we reward these people that buy these records? I look at Discogs as a great example of people who, in their spare time, create this database that I think they just released numbers that it would take over like 6 years or 600 years or something crazy like that to listen to all the things that have been uploaded to Discogs. But these are people that are creating a digital community. I think there's a lot of opportunity to build on top of those platforms using Web3 technology. And I know it's like a very hot topic these days, but I think the primary focus should always be value to the people who engage. I think we're allowed to imagine a future way of collecting records that involves this technology. So that's, yeah.
And where we take it is kind of up to us, isn't it? I mean, up to us as you know, good thinking and good acting human beings. Yep. You know, I mean, the irony of it is that a space where you could go and buy records and buy concert tickets and hear a band and run into people who were just like you, once upon a time was called a record store. and it's still called a record store in some ways, but like to duplicate that in the virtual world, I think is an amazing feat. And the thing you and I have talked about is you have to be careful that doesn't mean the sort of mass securitization of everything about the music experience, which is joining a listening lounge or being part of the fan club or getting to do an online Q&A with your favorite musician. If you add a price tag to all of that, and those things can be bought and sold, which is the future we are imagining with NFTs, or we're creating a market that is massively over securitized, which as we all know is a recipe for not only financial inequality, economic inequality, but financial collapse. I mean, that was essentially what was behind the 2008 financial collapse.
Yeah, there is a responsibility there because there's money involved in these transactions. But I always think about the access. An example could be like a local record store in a small town, right, where people love and they're very loyal to these record stores in these small towns. Let's say they release a collection of NFTs for about 25 people. The NFT holders can come and dig exclusively every Saturday morning when the new products are placed. and they get an exclusive dig. They only can buy one of each because they have to be fair. And let's say one of these collectors leaves town because they get a job on the other side of the country. They can now sell that NFT to someone else to become part of the collector's club there. You know, these are the practical things that I see, but there is responsibility, and that's the most important thing when it comes to this responsibility, to make sure that you do good and right by the people.
And I also want to say to that value, I think you said to the most engaged fans, right? Like when I think about music in the metaverse, I also think about what happens if it's like sneakers. Like I've talked to a lot of musicians who sell NFTs to people who aren't just genuinely fans. Like they're literally just doing it for the flip. You know, and so if everyone is buying music NFTs for the flip, then that can't be right. You know, like that can't be a net positive at the end of the day, I don't think.
No, we're creating a world where music is then like you know, like class C apartments that you know by the freeway that you.
It's a plus one. That's my new thing. I'm like, music is a plus one in too many places.
Yeah. Karen, starting with you, could we have everybody speak to the role that vinyl plays in your life as both a music fan and a business person?
As a music fan, I was a really casual collector of vinyl before starting my pressing plant, and I think a lot of younger buyers are, and often the vinyl industry kind of like shoos them away for getting Crosley record players, but it's a good starting point for so many people. And for me, it was a very family-oriented thing. I inherited my great-grandparents' record player from 1948. It hadn't been touched since 1965, and in fact, we didn't even know it existed. And pulled out all of this vinyl that belonged to my relatives, and I started to like understand my ancestry differently. So for me, it was so generational. As a vinyl manufacturer, I got into this because I wanted to help musicians earn more money from their music. I mean, the statistic that we often tell people is the average American band, in order to make minimum wage, can sell 100 vinyl records or accumulate close to 2 million YouTube views. So if you are a band that cannot scale that well, but you have a good fan base, like Felicia's talking about, loyal fans, it really is a very positive way to make money and to connect with your super fans. And that's what gets my team up every day. We love manufacturing the records, and especially since we're here in Austin, you know, musicians come pick them up from the factory, and we can wave goodbye to the records and meet the band and be there when they unbox it. There's nothing like that. It's this manifestation of an album that otherwise just gets dropped on Spotify. It's such a different feeling, and that's very special to be a part of.
I don't think I'm necessarily like the average, if there is an average, like vinyl fan. Definitely grew up with records, buying records. You know, I'm from Cleveland, and on the corner of my street was a record store. And so I was always in there buying things. And even throughout my travels as an adult, even if I didn't have a record player, I was still buying records. And like if I went to the Goodwill to buy something, I was getting records. And if someone had an estate sale, I was like, oh, I wonder what they have. And I love like vinyl jewelry. Like I just, you know, it looks beautiful to me. So that's the role that it plays personally. And I would say from a business perspective, I'm just always thinking about the future and how do we make it more accessible? How do we create more innovative and beautiful things? And I would say most importantly, how do we corral the community? You know, when I met Kevin during COVID, it was on a clubhouse group called Record House. And everyone was like, it was a bunch of hype rooms, but then it was like Record House. And I'm like, oh, these are the people who really love music. Like, I'm going to go over there and talk to them. And so I think there's so much more that we can do to bring the community together so that it's just continues to be a more enjoyable experience and also to grow it at the same time. So I hope to be a part of that.
As a fan, vinyl allows me to make deeper connections with people. I talk like with my dad about records that he used to listen to in the 60s, and you know he's from El Salvador, so when I go to El Salvador, I look for him. As a fan, that means a lot. Those records hold way more weight than, I don't know, whatever pop record, right? So I feel like the records, as a fan, tell a story about who I am and the people that I love the most. So that means a lot. As a business person, I think as a record retailer, it's I feel this responsibility to provide a really good experience for the collector, for the buyer, customer service, reliable shipping. We even rolled out, we tested a local delivery in LA within a certain mile radius. You know, why can't you order a record online and get it in 45 minutes like a pizza? Why not, right? You know, things like that, and trying to experiment in new ways to help the collectors and lessen the friction to, for people to get their records. So that's the responsibility that I feel from that side with vinyl records.
That's awesome. We're going to ask one more question, and then we're going to open it up for Q&A. So how do we do this? Do we line folks up at the microphone in the center of the room? Okay. We'll ask one more question, but if you're really chomping at the bit and you've got something to ask our panel, go ahead and start lining up at the microphone. At the end of the table, and please line up because we're just going to talk about records and shit for 40 minutes. And I'm not sure how interesting that's going to be to all of you. But starting with Karen and coming this way, what is the future of vinyl you are afraid of, and what is the future that you're hopeful for?
The future of vinyl that I'm afraid of is if the demand stays where it is, capacity stays where it is, that people will abandon the format, that people will get sick of waiting a year for new releases. I was in a conversation with a professor at Harvard who disagreed with me on that and said, actually, the lack of capacity is going to create scarcity that just grows the want for it. I hope that's the case, but it is a scary thing to think, like, vinyl went away before, will it go away again? What makes me hopeful is seeing a whole new generation, Gen Z, of really taking to vinyl. We oddly had tremendous success on TikTok because it's such satisfying content to watch vinyl records being made, and have accumulated a really large community there. And it's been fascinating as a pressing plant owner, because most of my competitors are much older than I am and are not looking to TikTok, but it's given us this kind of testing group to try out new ideas and see what vinyl fans care about. And a lot of it is the collectability, putting it on the wall, the sentiment of what does a record say about me when I pay for it, you know, that piece of it. So I'm very hopeful that there'll be new, whether it's through NFTs or new product development, that the younger generation will keep vinyl booming.
I would say that I fear the absence of innovation. And I think what kind of lends to that is the assumption that investing in this industry is not profitable. And so I don't know that a lot of investors would look at the vinyl industry and say, hey, we need to continue to evolve and iterate and grow this niche, right? Because is there enough money? Is it investable? So I fear that probably more than anything.
You got a hopeful, something you're hopeful for?
Good people. Yeah. good people with good intentions. Yeah.
Innovation, I actually do hope there's more innovation in this industry. But also I hope that, you know, we understand behaviors of collectors a little more. I think the record collector in 2028 is going to be totally different from the record collector in 1968. Mm-hmm. And that's important, and that can dictate a lot of things of how we deliver product to them. That's the hopeful. The one I'm not looking forward to is, I don't know, I guess I don't want to see record to 7-Eleven or something. I don't know. I saw it at Barnes & Noble, and I thought it was pretty cool, but it felt a little strange. But I don't know.
That's great. Let's give a hand for the panel. We're going to take some questions. Let us know whom on the dais up here you'd like to answer the question, and then we'll wrap it up with a little what everybody's up to next before we say goodbye. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, hi. My name's Nessa Johnston. I'm an academic based in the UK, and I do a lot of research about music and film, and I'm a massive vinyl enthusiast, and I DJ sometimes. So I've a tiny question and then for Karen, and then a bigger question for the panel. So the tiny question was more a clarification. You mentioned an amazing, for me, statistic about, I think you said in the US, the sale of 100 vinyl is equivalent to, was it 200 million YouTube streams?
Two million,
yeah. Okay, right.
Yeah, that might have changed. They changed the royalty rates, yeah. But that's the equivalent, yeah.
That's amazing. What's the source of that statistic?
We pulled a bunch of the royalty rate data, and... Uh-huh. profit margin information for, you know, just kind of extrapolating if an artist sells vinyl for $20 and Bandcamp takes this percentage, what does that equate to?
I find that really interesting just because, you know, very often artists I follow will just press a run of between 100 and 500.
Yeah.
And I always wondered, you know, how to the extent that that benefits them. So that's actually really heartening, I think.
Yeah, and that does that does take into, you know, if you do 100, it's very expensive because the setup cost for vinyl is the same whether we do 100 or 1,000 records,
right.
Just the cutting and plating part. But if you get an average run of about 300 to 500, which most of our clients do, that's where it kind of nets out. And I saw that as a band manager. I was collecting cash at these merch tables and seeing the real effect of, wow, this is real money in our pocket that we can use to pay for a hotel tonight versus waiting 6 months for a royalty statement and then 6 months for the payout of the royalties. Mm-hmm. So that's where our interest in kind of seeing what that looked like came from.
No, that's great. And then my question for the panel, I was just wondering what your thoughts are about the role of DJs in relation to vinyl, because, I mean, for certainly 20 years ago, a lot of the kind of scarcity with vinyl was very much driven by DJs snapping up, especially in dance music in the UK. And that would kind of drive demand and drive scarcity. But now so many DJs have gone digital. Like, I DJ with vinyl, but I'm finding I'm turning into a dinosaur. and very often everyone just show up with USB sticks. So I don't know if any of you have any thoughts about that.
I'll say that there's a whole section of our movie that speculates that the way that vinyl sort of migrated in the dark ages between its first heyday and its renaissance, DJ culture was a huge part of that, of what enabled that to happen. Mm-hmm. And we talk a lot about that in the movie, and also the transition that many DJs, you know, with the coming of technologies like Serato, essentially dumped their vinyl holdings because they could have a complete DJ experience on two hard drives that sort of mimicked the two turntable experience. I think the amazing thing, though, from the point of view of a vinyl person, that DJs do is the sort of proliferation of mixes on SoundCloud and platforms like that, and also DJing sets on YouTube that came about because of the pandemic. The number of records I have bought using DJ sets as a music discovery tool is massive, like three dozen at least, just because I was listening to, you know, DJ Jazzy Jeff do a set on YouTube. So I think it's from the fan point of view, I have found that in absence of being able to go to a nightclub, I have found that a DJ has become a significant music presence in my life. Maybe that's one of the few benefits to come out of the last 2 years, musically speaking.
That makes me think I should call one of my favorite DJs and say, you know, I love your stuff. You should put out a vinyl. Because I don't think he puts out vinyl. He does playlists.
Yeah.
But his name is Full Creighton. He's amazing. What's your DJ name, Nessa?
I don't really have one. I just use my own name.
You got to come up with one.
Yeah.
You know, I love DJs. I think they're a great and very important component of all this. You know, I try to gift my DJ friends like test pressings and stuff like that. You know, be kind to them so they can continue the ritual of you know, DJing with vinyl. So I think they're very important.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, y'all. My name's Berlin. I'm from over at Waxwork Records in New Orleans. I kind of
America's most musical city, as we like to say.
I wanted to kind of get y'all's, I know you talked about it a little bit in the beginning, but I wanted to get y'all's take on the larger labels, like reserving spots in pressing plants and its effects on, you know, indie labels and indie artists. Is there any hope?
I'm an outsider of vinyl, so I looked at it from a business perspective when I started my plant and saw this problem happening and made a really hard decision to say, my team will not play in that space. We're not going to take a contract with Universal, Sony, Warner, because it does tie up your capacity and then your business is essentially run by other companies. Like, they're telling you what to do and what order to go in. And so it's extremely tempting when you get these big jobs, and especially at the start of the pandemic, we made a mistake of taking a job that was too big for what we could do well, and it threw everything off. And so I think the hope is that they do see, yeah, we need more capacity. Either let's buy a plant and then force everybody around, or to, you know, or for my colleagues to say, we're not doing this anymore. We're not taking these large, low-margin jobs that make it also really difficult to hire, because if you're at these low prices so the major labels can maximize profit, it's really difficult to retain talent and to train people and to hire people. And so I'd love to see some of my other plants just say, hey, their plant's better suited to do the major label stuff. We'll focus on the indie and boutique things.
Yeah. As an indie label, it's very challenging. The plant that I usually go to is no longer taking orders, but last time I went to their warehouse, they had boxes of Red Hot Chili Pepper pressing. So they're popular releases, but it makes it very challenging. And now I'm forced to have to look around and find something else. And you know, it is very challenging. I hope they do find a solution. And thanks for being very punk rock about it. That's pretty cool. Yeah.
But it also, you know, it makes us better money too to do that. And that's important to talk about, because I want to create more jobs here in Austin and beyond. And for it to be a sustainable industry, it can't be this race to the bottom and frustrating fans and sending out bad product. Like, bad product, and we haven't talked about that, but bad quality of records will also turn people away from the industry. If you're spending $25 to $30 on a special variant color and it sounds like garbage, it's going to, fans are going to say, why bother with that, you know?
No, I'm glad you brought that up. Like, say what you want about streaming. There's no such thing as a warped MP3.
So. Or one that's bent by the post office when it says don't bend and it's like broken in half in your mailbox. What?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, this kind of jumps off of what you were saying. So I'm an artist, and I also have friends who run indie labels, and they've been very like vinyl-based labels. So I guess what I'm wondering is, so we have kind of like a near future window. Like, we can talk about NFTs, we can talk about all this stuff for, you know, within the next 10 years, but like, you know, like I have a record that's been in limbo for like a year, because if I even were to like press it now, I'd be waiting a year. I mean, I have a friend who's even trying to like look at stuff in Europe. I'm like, oh, let's shorten the time, whatever. But so what should artists, indie artists and labels be focusing on for the short term in order to stay relevant and stay alive and, you know, be present with people? And if we can't offer them, you know, that physical item yet, what can we offer them? I know there's tons of options, but I'm curious what your thoughts are.
I think the vinyl thing is very difficult. We just released a 45 that took 18 months to get into people's hands, and that was with a pre-sale. So I was like apologizing like every other day. And but I learned that communication and making sure that they're involved and maybe, you know, keeping them engaged. I know the turnaround is going to be crazy, but when it comes to fans, it's always about being transparent with them and try to, I don't think other formats are bad. I know we're talking about vinyl here, but I don't think CDs are too bad, you know? Maybe add like augmented value, make it a package. These are strategic things and we can talk, but you'd be surprised how much like a pack of stickers, like how far that goes with a fan, you know? Saying, hey, a handwritten note saying, hey, this is taking a while. I'm really sorry. Here's a pack of stickers. And thank you. And then, you know, they appreciate things like that. So you can work around that. But yeah.
I think another thing, this may not help in the immediate, but it seems like it could be a good idea to do some vinyl that isn't connected to a certain release, right? Where maybe it's like exclusives, it's old stuff on the cutting room floor that you never put out. So that way, if you run into delays later, you can be like, you know what? This isn't ready yet, but I have something else that I can send to you. In the meantime, I only send it to, you know, people that, you know, we have delays with. And then at least as a fan, like I'm feeling like, okay, I didn't get the new release yet, but man, she sent me something else, you know? So it gives me something to kind of be preoccupied with it. Maybe that could be, you know, smaller 45s or what have you. So that's just another suggestion.
One last thing, short runs are pretty cool too. They're a little more pricey, but they're an alternative.
Sir,
can I ask three questions?
Sure, they're quick.
Okay, Karen, quick one. Supply chain's an issue. Is there any part of the supply chain you're actually looking or exploring to start taking on yourself campaign?
We have been, yeah, since I started the company, I naively was like, let's bring it all in-house and vertically integrate this thing, as they say, right? We've looked at printing, but honestly, printing has been the easiest part of our supply chain, very consistent. But, you know, how do we get record jackets and center labels and things? The number one reason we reject records at our plant is the center label. Either the ink smears or it's off-center, and so that's been a huge problem for us. But I eventually would like to control more of what we do.
Awesome. And then in terms of record quality, this might be subjective, but does it matter if the original recording was done analog versus digital?
It'll always sound better if you put analog to analog.
Okay.
Always. That happens very infrequently. Most bands are doing digital now. But if you can get analog tape, oh, it sounds amazing. You start to hear little things that you're like, wow, that never came through in the compressed digital.
Is there a way for us to be able to determine when we're buying an album if it was recorded analog or not?
Hmm. The only way I can think of is that the studio was recorded at.
Yeah, the studio. There isn't, and that's a big thing, too, about the quality standards. The industry really has none and should be communicating these things when they say it's an audiophile record.
Right.
What does that mean?
Right. Yeah. That's, yeah. Okay. That be very careful around that. It's 180 gram, and we say it's an audiophile because we put a metallic sticker on the front of it. A lot of that is just hot air.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And then the last one's just fun. Each of you, name one album that you're digging right now on vinyl that's kind of unique.
Oh, shoot.
I should have known that question would come up.
No.
The latest record that I had got is like a duo, Megan Thee Stallion.
Oh, no, that's a good one.
Dinner Party LP. Mm-hmm. Fantastic jazz record.
I'm
still thinking.
Oh, God. I just did a complete listen from, I do this sometimes, from first album to last album of Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, second seven records, which you can buy any of those on vinyl, and if you're not sweaty and horny afterwards, you don't have a pulse.
my number one most listened to on Spotify in the past 2 years has been the same one, it's same for vinyl, it's Caroline Polachek's debut album, Pang. Really love that record.
Yes.
Yeah. So I don't know if I have a question as much of a statement, but first off, I love this documentary. It was great.
Thank you.
I saw it when it first came out.
That's really,
it was really
nice.
Powerful. So I'm a DJ from Chicago. I have like 10,000 records, and all I do is vinyl. So we're out here. I guess my question, though, I've been really following this supply chain thing. And at first I was like, you know, down with the establishment, down with UMG, but at the end of the day, it's like these big releases are kind of lifting all the boats. So really the issue is there a concerted effort to get more plants? Because after that fire, that seemed catastrophic for a lot of this causing this issue. So I don't know, I haven't heard any word on the street about that, other than the tiny guys, you know. Jacksonville, there used to be a huge plant, pressed products. There was like huge plants at one point. Are the big guys going to actually like take the...
So what we've heard, I'll start by saying we ordered two new machines last March that normally would have taken 3 months. I still don't have them. And one is apparently in the port of Miami, I found out yesterday, but when am I going to get it out? I don't know. The machine makers can't keep up with the demand either, and what we've heard is that some of the bigger plants in Europe have bought up almost all the machines. So it is really difficult to expand right now. You know, an investor approached me and said, if I gave you $10 million today, what would you do with it? And I said, honestly, I can't do much because I can't get new machines. So that's going to be the hardest thing. That we have heard that there's a lot of growth coming in the United States, big plants, and in Europe, and that can help. But you're right, the big releases, the Olivia Rodrigo vinyl, Taylor Swift, that does introduce a whole new this Gen Z group that I'm talking about that are finding the format. So it is a really good thing that those artists have vinyl. One thing that scares me, and you and I talked about it a little bit in the hallway, is there's been chatter about whether or not retailers will still have to keep what they buy. So right now, if you're in a store, and correct me if I'm wrong, any retailers out there, when you buy vinyl, if it doesn't sell, you're stuck with that inventory. You can't sell it back like you can with CDs. There's been talk about removing that for vinyl, which would force suddenly a Target can say, I don't know how much Adele we're going to sell. Let's get 40,000 units. And if we don't sell it, we can sell it back. That will kill the industry. So I really hope that doesn't happen. But we should see more more expansion and the big plants coming soon?
I hope so, because otherwise it's going to be a bubble. I mean, that's the way I'm just really watching it closely. I really hope that happens.
Hello. My name is Franz. I come from Italy, so I apologize for my English.
Great.
First of all, thank you so much for this panel and this documentary. I'm really excited to watch it. I run a record label called Wild Honey Records, and I used to work in a pressing plant in Italy, which was pressing records since the 60s. And they had a deal, like, you know, they had a deal now. They've been forced to agree with Sony. And so now Sony is controlling, like, the pressing plant. And it's very hard for do-it-yourself and small record labels like mine to press vinyl now. We all know this. And so my question is, and the previous questions have been perfect, so, you know, I had to change mine. Prices, you know, because we don't speak too much about price. And my point of view is, from one, I understand the business side of the thing, and we focused a lot on that, but we also should focus on bringing back the passion and, you know, inspire people with the passion for music. You know, vinyl is important for us. I think it could be important for someone else. But when I come to the U.S. in particular, I see that the record stores, in particular the new ones, you know, you said like the Sharon Jones records or Depton records, they are so pricey, at least for Europeans. And this is a problem. You know, it seems like sometimes to me that the business side is killing the vinyl industry, not helping it to lift it up. Mm-hmm. Because from one point of view, the small record labels and the do-it-yourself record labels like mine, we are like forced to play the same game and with the same tools, and of course we don't have the capacity. At the same time, it seems like people is more focusing on a luxurious way of intending vinyl. You know, you buy stuff because it's limited, because it's expensive, yeah. Because it's, you know, even the record labels like mine, we have to now focus on selling like test pressings or doing limited edition, vinyl edition, color edition, yeah. Which is cool to me, but as a, you know, I really, really thankful for what music gave me. And so I want to give it back. So what my first idea is, like, when I'm releasing a new band, I want to spread it to the world. I don't want to do only limited batch of records for few people that are collectors. I want the young people, you know, the kids, the punks, like kids, to listen to it. So I think price is an issue. And every time I come back to America every year to South by Southwest, I see like $2 more, $3 more. So I do understand the business side of the thing, but I don't think we focus enough on the thing that the price is like in the old days when I grew up in the punk scene, there was always a sticker written something like, you saw that on Billy Bragg Records, like, don't pay more than this. Yeah. Don't pay. You know, the ethic on this, it seems like it is forgotten. So I don't know if it's a question, but
it's a great question. Let's get everybody to speak to prices really quick, because I think what's at the heart of what Franz is saying is no one is in this business to turn records into Fabergé eggs into a luxury product, only available to rich people, or only available even to upper middle class people. So. Somebody will. But I would say, I mean, just for me, I would say it is very anti-capitalist, but we have not gotten this notion out with records that buying used records is as good as buying new vinyl. The book industry has accomplished this, and I think they've accomplished this because we have public libraries, which give people the notion that books are not always newly bought product. Young people, on the whole, in my experience, still think you are supposed to buy new records, and they don't know enough that buying a used record is an equivalently good experience and a cheaper one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's enough. I'm always fascinated when I go to partner plants and see things like Fleetwood Mac's Rumours being repressed at these quantities. I'm like, there are millions in the crate bins. Why are people paying $40 for a reissue of this record that sounds better in its original format? It's baffling to me, and I think it's largely probably, and I love your perspective, Eric, that it's harder to find that stuff unless you go to somewhere like Discogs or eBay, whereas you walk into Urban Outfitters and there's a copy of that. Oh, that's easy. Let me grab that. So the pricing piece is going to get harder, too, because plastic prices just went up about 65%. Last year they went up about 25%, so it's going to get tighter, and I worry about that myself, about pricing out people to press records, but especially what does that look like in terms of the retail price?
Yeah. I mean, it always pains me when I have to price the new records because, you know, I got to protect the margin to operate. But they keep going up, like you said. So price points is something I think about a lot. And I think when it comes to used records, we think of used records just sitting in a bin somewhere. But I think when, like my earlier point, there could be an experience available for people to buy used records, and it's much more like buying the new record. When I release records that are like licensed from the label, like I would love to sell at a much cheaper price, but it's kind of unsustainable. But price points are very important, and I think we're all just kind of trying to figure out the best way to do this, considering all the issues that the plants are dealing with, and not trying to like push away collectors. So yeah.
Really good point. I don't know if it would be welcoming, but it seems like I could imagine there being kind of levels to vinyl, and maybe on the higher end, it's actually packaging it with something else, yeah. You know, because that could then, for the person or the company selling it, you can make more, but then if you're paying more, you're getting more. So I could imagine, like, more vinyl kind of bundling with other products, yeah, or experiences is maybe a solution.
Sir, I'm going to have you address your question to the panel afterwards, sure, whoever you want to address it to. I want everybody to get a chance to announce or plug what they've got going on.
Gold Rush Vinyl is trying to expand. We're waiting on those machines to add capacity. That'll double our capacity and hopefully bring our turn times down naturally. We also have a commitment to pushing sustainability further in the industry. I'm really concerned with how much waste happens in the industry. Most pressing plants throw about 35% of records away as waste and either chop them up and put them back through, or they go to landfill. So we've been opening up some new business units with our recycled vinyl to find new homes for it.
Great to hear.
If you make music or you know an amazing artist, I'd love to hear it and get your support with my app, Breaker Nation. It's available on the App Store and on Google Play. If you're with a music company, I'd love to talk about hosting some more vinyl conversations.
That's a great piece of technology.
NormandyRecords.com is adopting NFT sales that are attached to vinyl records, where, for example, like if you buy the NFT, you keep receiving the represses, the 45s, the DJ 12 inches. So you buy the first one, you keep receiving it. So, you know, rewarding the fan. So, and it's very accessible. Check it out, NormandyRecords.com, and you can also dig through there.
Vinyl Nation, distributed by 1091 Pictures, who did the Linda Ronstadt documentary on Netflix, will be released on April 19th in anticipation of Record Store Day. Thank you. Pre-orders available digitally on April 2nd on iTunes, Google Play, Vudu, all the places you can watch movies digitally in the United States and in the rest of the world on Vimeo On Demand beginning April 2nd. Thank you all for being here. This was great. And I think the panel will stick around and answer questions of anybody who wants to.